Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Save big money on your next project now at Menards. Update your home with low-maintenance vinyl windows from JELD-WEN. They're durable, energy efficient, and are low maintenance. Menards carries over 100 different size and style options in stock, ready to take home today. Save big on JELD-WEN windows now at Menards. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Hi, I'm Martin.
Hi, I'm Lars, and we're Damn Swindle.
And you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
Perfect.
Fox nailed it. Okay, thanks for your time. See you later.
House Culture.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the House Culture Podcast, hosted as ever by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. First off, I'd like to thank you, the listener, for tuning into this show today. It really means a lot to us all at House Culture that you're dedicating the next hour or so of your listening time to this content we lovingly put together just for you. However, if this is your first time here, I'd like to pull back that velvet rope and welcome you to House Culture. We are a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Instagram is our spiritual home, so if you don't already, follow us over there at HouseCultureNet to get connected to over 100,000 party people from this here planet Earth. And you or old listeners, please don't forget to get stuck into the other episodes we've released in this series. We've been heavy on the D's in this season 4, so we've featured chats with progressive house titan Dave Seaman, house music's number one vocalist and songwriter Dwayne Harden, drum and bass legend Darren Jay, and legendary Shelley's regular Dave Ralph. If you want to continue that theme, you can go even further back and listen to our conversations with Dawn Hindle, David Morales, Dave Ralph, or even the Dannys, Clockwork, Rampling, or Tenaglia. It's up to you. Now in this episode, we're adding to those D's as we sit down with a duo from Amsterdam who have lit up the scene over the past few years with their Essential EPs, eclectic DJ sets, and iconic record label. Individually, they are Lars and Martin, but together, they are Damn Swindle. In this chat, you'll hear how Lars got his first taste of dance music.
I remember walking into Melkweg, and this was a HQ hard house party, and I literally lost my mind. The music was just insane, and I was hooked right there and then.
You'll hear Martin tell us why they started producing music as a duo.
One of the reasons that we started getting into the studio together was that we were both a bit disappointed in Amsterdam nightlife at the time, but it did fuel our energy to create it ourselves.
The ups and downs of playing your own material in a club environment.
Making your own music and then playing it out for a crowd that reacts in a way that you're hoping they would react is something very special.
It's also the high you get from the reaction of a crowd when the track really works well, or where you're like, you're on the right path. The low is like equally low when you feel like you've over-mixed the kick and then you just want to like mix out the record after a minute because you feel so bad.
And how they work together as a team in the studio.
Back in the day, we even used to have fights about this because we both had such a specific creative idea behind it. But that friction also makes the art better.
I completely disagree. It's true. It's annoying, but it's also a part of the process.
I hope you enjoy this one. This is Damn Swindle.
House Culture.
Hi, Lars and Martin. It's great to have you join us on the House Culture podcast today. Thanks so much for taking the time to do so. You are Dam Swindle, a duo famed for your eclectic taste in music, heads of a label that always delivers class and quality, and you've also released many tracks that are considered classics amongst the house music community. However, we always want to start at the beginning and understand how you guys got to where you are today. Now, it can be either Lars or Martin. I don't know who goes first, but can you tell us where you grew up and how you first discovered house music?
Okay, I'll start. Hello, first of all. I grew up in Amsterdam. I've lived here all my life, 40 years now. I know I don't show it. Thank you.
This is a podcast, Lars.
Nobody sees it. anyway, I used to be really into hip hop when I was younger. And I bought record players with my best friend and downstairs neighbor, Flawless. And we started DJing hip-hop records sitting down because we thought that was the easiest way to do it. And then we saw on MTV that you should be standing up. So we put it on the table. And then his half-brother, after a school party, said, where I DJed actually when I was like 14 or 15, mm-hmm. He said, hey, listen, I'm going to go to this party at Melkweg in Amsterdam. I think you would really like it. And I was like, well, okay, mm-hmm. I'll just go with you. And we went on this little scooter to Melkweg. And just before going in, he said, well, if we're going to go in, I think you should, everybody takes these little pellets here. And I was like, okay, whatever, I'll do that. And I remember walking into Melkweg, and this was a HQ hard house party, mm-hmm. with DJs Tom Harding and JP. And I literally lost my mind. I was like, what the hell am I seeing? Uh-huh. What the hell am I experiencing? How are all these people so cool and happy and beautiful? And the music was just insane. And I was hooked right there and then. Mm-hmm. I was hooked into the nightlife and hooked into the music and into the culture. And I basically spent the next 7 years as a raver. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I would do my school stuff and I would do all my chores at the house. I wasn't really
studious.
I was okay, but I was an easy kid, you know, also from my mom, and I was helpful, but in the weekends I would just lose my shit and go to any rave I could find. I went to Berlin to the Love Parade when, mm-hmm. it was still there, mm-hmm. and all these things, and I'm really thankful that I experienced that. So that's my start with house music, and then with a lot of like back and forth to hip hop again and soul and funk. And then I rediscovered house through a friend of mine again in the early 2000s, mm-hmm. and never looked back.
Brilliant. And, you know, it's interesting that you had that kind of hip hop experience to begin with. I'm sure we can kind of talk about some of that as well. So, but before we do that, Martin, what was your entrance into the house music scene?
It's funny because it's very typical for me. But my entrance into the house scene was way later and much more of a business thing rather than that experiencing it as a raver. Mm-hmm. I used to be in bands, like I played drums and we did punk and like surf rock, stuff like that. And that was my high school fun. And then during my student years, basically I spent my time getting experience from lots of different work-related things. I was just into, like, I wanted to learn everything. Mm-hmm. And then I got into DJing through a friend and we started buying records together. And I was like, fuck, I want to learn this as well. This is great. But I didn't go to any parties. Like, I had some friends that would listen to these like early 2000s Tiesto CDs. Mm-hmm. I was like, yeah, okay. It's, you know, whatever. I see that you like it. Great. It wasn't really my thing, but I could get it. I could get the appeal. Mm-hmm. I just didn't get the whole like waiting in line and queuing up and like getting geared up for a night worth of not sleeping, because basically my days were like getting up early, doing sports, and just working the hell out of everything. So and then through work, I got introduced to an Israeli guy who lived in Amsterdam who was famous in the gay scene running electro parties. Mm-hmm. And we had a really good connection, like from a business level, because he was, I remember his voice, his name is Roy Avni. He died of cancer, unfortunately, quite a long time ago already. But his voicemail was, "Hi, this is Roy. I'm not here right now. I'm either on the motorbike or in the gym." And this is actually true. I don't think he ever slept. He was just either on his way to a meeting or to a party, or he was working out in the gym. He was like super buff, but the sweetest guy ever. And he had no clue of anything like business-wise, mm-hmm, from the dance scene or from doing parties, but he had this immaculate vision of what he wanted to bring to the Amsterdam crowd and to people. So he had these artists that he just felt like he needed to promote them. Like, these people need a stage. Mm-hmm. He was the complete opposite from me. Like, he was so tapped in and engaged with that feeling. And I really liked that. I was like, yeah, man, let's do this together. Let's spend time. So I started doing like the business thing for him and making sure that we sorted everything out. But after years of working with him, his enthusiasm really got to me. Mm-hmm. So I started like feeling the same and hearing that music that he was doing, like Doppler effect shows. And he shared me like all these weird niche electro acts that nobody ever books because they're just too, I don't know what it is, left field, highbrow, weird, intelligent, however you want to call it. I mean, people, there will be like 50 people buying a ticket for a 600 capacity club. So he would lose all of his money and still walk around being happy as he can be, because he was like, look what we made possible. And so his enthusiasm, I kind of took that from him. Mm-hmm. And then we started doing like techno nights in the same club where Lars was doing a hip hop night. Mm-hmm. Lars and me met up and I started playing some music in like bars and clubs and stuff. And that's kind of how I gradually rolled into the creator side of the dance music.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you talk about that first meeting and you mentioned Lars was playing like hip hop or whatever. Lars, just take us through, like, at that stage, were you very much into that was your sound and that was your what you were DJing, and kind of how did you guys have a meeting of minds and think, okay, let's make something with each other?
Well, it's quite a long story, but the short version is that I used to have a different business partner and we used to program a couple of locations in Amsterdam, and we had this group of people that would DJ next to us. We would DJ ourselves as well, but also some other people that we asked, like, hey, do you want to DJ at these places that we can arrange this for you and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And one of those people was Ruben. And Ruben was back then Martin's business partner. And they would work in an ad agency and also both DJ on the side sometimes. So Martin would sometimes sub for Ruben. Mm-hmm. And at one point, Martin was just a regular in our club of people, and we would program him mostly at a gay bar in Amsterdam. And at one point, the owner was like, yeah, this guy is super nice, and the guys, the crowd seems to like it, but I want different kind of music in my bar. So I would have a conversation with Martha, like, hey, listen, this is the case. You know, your music is awesome, but, you know, they want something different. And he was like, well, then I don't want to do it anymore. And I thought it was so cool. It's like, yeah, he doesn't give a shit that this was great music. And so back then I was already making some tracks at home, mm-hmm, on my little laptop back then with first, I don't know, Ableton 4 or 5, whatever, like, or even earlier. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why don't you come by my house and we'll have a beer and I'll show you what I'm working on, because I think, you know, if you have good music taste, maybe you can just listen to it. And then we did that, and that was very fruitful. And Marta, he didn't know anything about making music back then, but he had some really good pointers, and we felt like, hey, this is something that could work. And that was basically the start of a weekly Wednesday night fueled with Heinekens and playing some video games and making tunes together.
As anything in Amsterdam is fueled by Heineken. What kind of music were you putting together initially? Was it, you know, what kind of influences were you bringing into that? I mean, Martin, you mentioned like punk rock, surfer rock and things like that. Were you bringing that influence into this kind of sound or?
No, not really. I remember when Lars showed me those projects, was like, yeah, this sounds cool. But it was just like swing things or just like sample chops that were like, yeah, this needs something else. Mm-hmm. And this was just, Lars was really open as well. So we were just basically, you know, messing around in Ableton and moving around samples and seeing whether this is the right clap and whether we would need like another hi-hat vibe, or it was really organic the way that this came together. Mm-hmm. So I guess, I mean, all of these musical influences played a role in where we were at the time. And my dad used to listen to like everything Motown related, like mm-hmm. he would play Otis Redding, Marvin Gaye and stuff like that. And that was that part of the stuff that he played I really liked, apart from like he also did like Level 42, great bass player, not really my mm-hmm. music style. And he played Toto and I hated that, and he played it a lot, but like all the Motown stuff I loved. Mm-hmm. And there was really, because the first tracks we worked on were was actually turned out to be the Wraparound EP that we released mm-hmm. later on. So mm-hmm. that was really Motown influenced. So I had this immediate connection with the songs. Like, yeah, this is my vibe. And it's also that one of the reasons that we started getting into the studio together was that we were both a bit disappointed in Amsterdam nightlife at the time, because mm-hmm. it was really minimal techno and techie oriented. So we felt like there was zero soul in music, like popular music at that time. I'm sure it was there, but we couldn't find it. Mm-hmm. And we were really looking for that warmth and kind of an upbeat feel in electronic music that we just didn't see. Like, it wasn't getting played in the clubs. We didn't have any background to know that, oh, then you have to go to this and this club because they play that, or you have to just, you know, buy the recent Moody Man album or whatever, you know. So we were super blunt in our judgment on the Amsterdam nightlife, but it did fuel our energy to create it ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, that's a punk rock spirit, right? That is
it is.
Yeah, I mean, so what kind of came first? That, well, I mean, you're producing stuff in the studio. Did then you think you could go out there and perform as a duo, as a DJ duo, or was it the production stuff that was coming first? How did that kind of seep into your lives?
Well, Lars was doing events, so he basically booked us to do like warm up sets, so that was easy. But
that's kind of true, though.
Yeah, it is true. So we weren't really part of any crew. Mm-hmm. Like we created kind of our own space, which I feel was really powerful, but was also a challenge, because there's, you know, if you're part of the Rush Hour crew, you have this giant platform to get launched upon when you're good enough. Mm-hmm. And we basically did everything ourselves, releasing our own music like with a couple of labels that were not connected to anything that was happening in the Netherlands at the time. So by the time we had like four or five releases, people in Holland that were doing parties were still completely oblivious of who we actually were. Mm-hmm. So production came first with us, mm-hmm. like with our popularity as well. We started gigging outside of the Netherlands first, like in the UK, Germany, France, and Holland came way later. Like it took a really a long time for the Netherlands to pick up what we were doing.
Mm. Also, I would say that the sound that really hit for us in the beginning was something that was popular in the UK and Germany at the time, and not so much in Holland.
Yeah,
yeah.
So I would say that also, I think our notoriety in the UK really kickstarted our fame, or our claim to fame. And in Holland, it was just way more like that minimal, more techie sound still. that early 2000s tech house slash minimal sound.
Yeah.
So we were playing a lot of in Germany and in the UK in the beginning, mm-hmm. and really made a name for ourselves there. Not so much in Holland yet.
Did so when you're playing out and you're booking yourselves, were you playing your own things? And, you know, was that exciting for you? Were you getting the reactions that you felt like you should be getting when you're putting those things together in the studio?
Yeah, of course. That's still something that's really great. Mm-hmm. Like it's something that we really enjoy doing, and making your own music is something so special. And then playing it out for a crowd that reacts in a way that you're hoping they would react is something very special. But I was always I've been making way before that, for already, I would say 10 years, I would be dabbling and making edits. And I even did like those Baltimore kind of breakbeat edits of famous hip hop tracks or disco tracks. And I did some disco edits as well. So mm-hmm. I was kind of used to playing those out, but this felt as something different though, because this was so uniquely us.
Yeah, and way more original as well.
And way more original, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We get some samples in, but I mean, it's very much an original production already in the beginning. It's also the high you get from the reaction of a crowd when the track really works well, or where you're like, you know, where you feel like you're on the right path. Mm-hmm. The low is like equally low when you feel like you've overmixed the kick, or when there's the drop that's just way too long, or that hi-hat is just piercing through your eardrums. You're like, oh man, we messed up this mix so badly. And then you just want to like mix out the record after a minute because you feel so bad.
Fun fact, people thought in the beginning that we were like these super old school vintage hardware style producers, mm-hmm. while we were just making it on a laptop, but we just didn't know how to properly mix it. So it just sounded very shit in a way good. So people thought we were already like on the scene for a long time. And just now popping up. And
well, that's so cool, right? I mean, like sometimes when you're putting it through and you're just creating it digitally, it can sound so crisp and so clear and so clean that you need some of that, you know, that earthiness in there every now and again.
Yeah. It's something that I teach my students as well. And I take myself as an example. Like I told you just before the interview that I teach at the conservatory now, and I literally tell them this story. Like people thought we were these very, you know, the story that I just told you. Mm-hmm. And they always listen in amazement, because their productions, they sound incredibly well mixed, mm-hmm. like insanely well mixed. But because of that, sometimes it lacks a little bit of identity. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, that's something that also stuck with us. Like we sometimes intentionally leave some messy parts in our tracks just to have that sort of vibe. Consistency in our and vibe in our sound.
And you know, this how house music first actually started. It was just people just messing around with things and just putting things onto vinyl, and they weren't necessarily clean. And you can listen back to some of the older stuff, and you know, there is a bit of swing to it, and there is a bit of you know, hard edits here and there, and things, claps that can pierce you and things like that. It's That's what makes it so interesting and exciting. I mean, so when you're in the studio, what's your kind of flow between each other? Does anyone look after something individually? You know, and how do you kind of manage your disagreements? Is it a democratic process or?
Well, actually, yesterday we had kind of an interesting situation that happens a lot. I'll tell the short story and then Marta can chime in.
I'll tell a completely different story probably.
we're making tracks for our Keep On Swindling EPs for mm-hmm. this year, for the 10-year anniversary, and we just finished one EP. And for example, one of us starts like a concept and the other one, you know, works on it for a while, and then we sort of switch back and forth, and then we work together in the studio edit. And it's never a set way that we do it, because also our schedules are a bit chaotic sometimes with all the touring and family and schoolwork. But this time Marta worked quite long on one specific project and really had, you know, a specific idea. And then I felt like, hey, I want to change a couple little things because I feel like it's a good idea, but maybe we can add or subtract some bits here and there. And yesterday I showed him for the first time. And then I saw Marta's face going like, okay. Breathe in, breathe out. Back in the day, we even used to have fights about this because we both had such a specific creative idea behind it. But over the years, you really get to know how to work together. And, and you know, now we have a bit more of patience. And then like, okay, I know this is not what I had in mind, but I also kind of feel that I should give him that leeway. And then after a while, it will grow on you and it will end up a better track always. I mean, that's the power that we have together. And I think that goes for everything, like our personalities, but also our DJ sets, but specifically the studio, you know, that friction also makes the art better.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely disagree.
No, it's true. It's true. It's annoying, but it's also a part of the process. And sometimes I think we've gotten better at this as well, because there would be like the arguments would be way heavier a couple of years back, where we just say, no, man, go away. Don't touch this. This is good as it is. You don't need to change it. It's not getting better. It's just getting different. I guess the past few years has also given us the time to kind of reflect how we were approaching our work and how we were approaching our partnership. I think that with that experience and with the age also comes more nuance. And, you know, we give each other the time to show the ideas that we have. And I mean, it's a shared product. It's something we make together. So there's always going to be an EP where there's more of Lars' identity in it or more of mine, and it's totally fine. Just a matter of over the whole course of a couple of releases, you want to make sure that, you know, we feel like it's really us. And yeah, I think we've gotten really good at that. I also think that there's definitely a difference between these kind of projects that start individually or where we have just like a really basic sketch and then we jam in the studio. Because I think Body Control, the new, is a really good example of how Lars made a really funky like sketch, and we just fired up the machines in the studio, and I think within an hour we had the whole track laid out. And just because of just like messing around on the keys a little bit, recording some stabs, rearranging them, and then the track was there, and it came so natural. Like, there was zero discussion. There was only like, hey, I like this, let's add this, let's add that. And then we recorded like a little ARP and the track was done.
Amazing. Yeah, so I mean, that flow in the studio, so natural. And, you know, you've got that mature approach that's, you know, you recognize what each one brings to the party, you know, if you're making something individually or, you know, just jamming and things are coming together really, really quickly. And sometimes those are the best things, right? I mean, in terms of you guys DJing together, you're obviously a duo behind the decks. What are the rules of engagement between yourselves there?
Well, it's a bit similar. We started off DJing one track and one track each, but we felt like that was a bit too short, because sometimes you need a while before you sort of get in tune in the set. And then if you constantly doing only one track, you can't really set a certain mood.
Yeah.
So then we decided to do two tracks each, which makes it a bit more solid in a way, because then if one sets a certain mood, then the other one can really pick up on that and sort of, or decides not to, that's still a thing. But yeah, that's we talk a lot about like, hey, what are we going to play next? Where do we want to go? Like, okay, we have 3 hours. What's the crowd like? What's the party like? What's the DJ behind us? you know, we discuss this a lot, and sometimes we completely don't. We just rock up to a venue and then put on the first record, and then suddenly it's 2 hours later and we haven't spoken one word and said everything through records. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it depends on the vibe. It depends on the moment as well.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say there's like a certain way to do it, but we do talk a lot about the vibe and how we're gonna do it, and also before the gig we really talk through the gig, like, hey, what kind of venue are we playing, what kind of people are there, which other DJs are there, so mm-hmm. we can sort of focus a bit on what we think we should be playing mm-hmm. within the context of what we play, because we play quite eclectically mm-hmm. so we can go so many ways basically. So sometimes you really want to narrow it down for yourself as well a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned eclecticism, you know, you guys play across all of those different genres. It could be, you know, house, a bit of techno, some disco, some old school, you know, across everything. It can be a real education listening to one of your sets, which is great. And like as someone on the dance floor, that sense of not necessarily knowing what's coming next is so exciting. Do you have a favorite genre that sometimes you maybe want to steer one of them down towards, or is it just mainly feeding off the vibe in the club?
No, well, I mean, there's favorite genres, and there's like tracks that you just discovered or new releases that you have that you really want to play out. Mm-hmm. But I think over time we've also learned to kind of, if you can't play this party, it'll be a next party. And there are certain special tracks that really have this moment on a dance floor, and you keep them to the parties where you know or where you feel like they are gonna have the effect and have the interaction that you want them to have, rather than kind of just falling out of the out of a clear sky and just basically not doing anything, which is kind of a shame. It feels like a waste of moment. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also a thing of like the current time asks for different music than what we would do 2 or 3 years ago, just before COVID. Mm-hmm. Like, the tendency has gone to way harder and faster music, mm-hmm. more techie. Mm-hmm. And we find our way in that. There's plenty of stuff that we like that's like 135 BPM, so we can do, you know, we can do that. Even though, like, when we started, we would, like, it would be 2 or 3 a.m. if we do an all-nighter, and we might still be on 116 or 117 BPM playing like Italo and funk, stuff like that. So mm-hmm. and it's okay that there's less space for that right now. You know, we find the right gigs for it. Mm-hmm. And that eclecticism is something we can, you know, we can do in many ways, because you can go from 135 BPM acid and straight into disco. Yeah. Which is great. Like, I love these clashes of styles, and sometimes they work out really well, and sometimes you completely blow it and then you need to fix it again in the next two tracks, but then that's up to Lars, so that's totally fine for me.
It's funny, but it's true.
But are there ever any moments, you say you talk a lot between each other, which is really good to have that communication, are there ever any moments where you're like, I've got this track in my back pocket and, you know, I want to surprise the other one with this or take it this way?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we do that as well. Like, and then, yeah, what was it? The other day, Lars picked up this old DJ Gregory track. And he was like, don't look at the title. Don't look at the title. I'm going to play it and you're going to love it. And he played it. I was like, I haven't heard this track in so long, man. Mm-hmm. This is so much fun. And sometimes you'll be like, no, I'm not going to show you what I'm playing because you might comment and then you might not feel like it's a good idea, but I just feel like it has to happen right now. And then we'll see if it's a good idea afterwards. Like, yeah, you go out for a drink and I'll try this now.
And when you're DJing together, I mean, is there, what equipment have you got to have with you in the booth? Do you have a particular mixer? Is it vinyl, CDJs? You know, where do you stand on all of that?
We have our own mixer. We've had Condessa Carmen for a while. And before that, we had the Condessa Lucia. Mm-hmm. And
the Carmen is a four-channel rotary
mixer.
With the warmest sound you'll ever
you'll ever find in a mixer.
In our humble opinion, it's probably the best sounding rotary mixer, at least portable rotary mixer out there. And you can literally not fuck the sound up with this mixer. Like, you cannot, even if you, I don't know, just put everything on 10, it sounds great. And I feel that's quite a difference from some other rotary mixers out there, where I've heard DJs literally rape some sound systems on. That's something that we always take. We have very specific vinyl weights that have a weighted 45 insert inside, which is the only one we've ever seen made that way. It's made by a furniture maker, bag, something.
No, US design company decided to go into this one little niche 40 record weight adventure, which we were really happy with. So we have two record players, two CDJs, our own mixer. We used to bring an effects pedal as well, because the mixer has send and receive, and then so we brought the space echo pedal, which was really nice. I'm not sure why we don't bring it anymore. Oh, it's broken.
Well, I do know. Because I remember one time we were playing at party, so in Amsterdam, and at one point we were DJing, and then we had like this beautiful piano breakdown, and then the fire alarm went off in Paradiso, like so loud that like we stopped the music and we're like, man, we have to fix this first before we can play. And it took so long. And then at one moment we figured out it was not a fire alarm. It was literally our space echo just looping in on itself, like
oh my god.
We didn't dare tell the organizers that it was us, because we were kind of annoyed at the venue, like there were literally like 1,000 people standing there waiting for the fire alarm to go off, and then in the end it was just our space echo pedal.
So you stopped the music and it was still going?
Yeah,
because we just turned the music off, but the space echo has its own channel and it was just on, and we weren't really, we know that it can feedback loop into itself, but this type of sound was not we weren't familiar with it, like mimicking a fucking fire alarm.
But we should take it again though. It's a really fun tool to use, especially when you're playing like disco stuff, and you can make cool transitions with it and sort of build ups and breakdowns, and it's a really fun thing. That's our basic setup, and then Martin,
we bring our own slip mats.
Yeah, that's true,
because they're nice and thick and soft cushions for our precious records. which I Lars at some point the amount of effort it took to bring records didn't really weigh up to the fun anymore. I think at some point Lars realized he was basically bringing a bag full of records for me to play. I bring records, and then Lars maybe brings like 10 or 15 along with the mixer, and then we have a shared bag of fun stuff to play.
Cool. And you've also done a lot of remix work as well, and I'm thinking of last year you did some work with Soul. And remixed it was Every Man, Double Exposure, Let No Man Put Asunder, First Choice, and some others as well. I mean, like, those are absolute classics that everyone is like familiar with. How did that come about? Was that a dream job? Was it a nightmare because you're taking on a classic? Was it scary? Just take us through the background on those.
It was everything you're just mentioning. We were like, I remember when we got into the conversation with Salsol, and so we all liked the idea of doing like a full remix EP. And then they sent over this Excel sheet. It was like, here's the tracks you can choose from our catalog. And I think it took us 3 or 4 weeks to go through like the full Excel sheet, because it's the complete Celso discography. And they're like, yeah, there's no way we can choose from this. So we had to, at some point we made this long list, then a short list. And then we got to the discussion on, are we actually gonna like do any of the classics that, you know, Larry Levan has done. And it took us a while to get used to the idea of doing something like that. Mm-hmm. Then it took us another while to decide whether we had something new to offer to to the original recording and the available remixes. So we extensively, especially for Let No Man, because I think Every Man is still, a lot of people know it, but it hasn't been that remixed that much as, mm-hmm. as Let No Man. So we listened to all the old recordings and the million different versions there are. And then at some point we did feel confident, like there was still a story to be told that had our name on it and had like felt like our like modern day disco house / disco interpretation of the track. Mm-hmm. And they were like, okay, we're gonna do it. We can always say it's not gonna work out, we'll do something else. But we after giving it some thought, we felt confident that we could make something really nice. And we decided to record a lot of new material, so with new bass player and new keys, mm-hmm. switching up the arrangement quite a bit, and obviously we beefed up the percussion a bit to make it, more welcoming for modern day sound systems. Mm-hmm. And then, the track turned out the way it did, and it got some really good, it was received really well. Mm-hmm. And we don't play it a lot.
There's one comment on the YouTube video that I really, really like. And that's one guy, he says that he expected it to be, because there's so many versions out there, literally, he said that he expected this one to not be an addition to them. And he was pleasantly surprised that it was. That, I think, in one comment sums it up for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, for sure. We'll have to see if it stands the test of time. But I'm pretty sure that it will remain playable for quite a while, and it's nice because it has a different energy. I mean, there's like the more clubbier versions, and this is actually quite easy to listen to, and has this warm vibe that's really that really feels authentic to us. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was a long process. But we, when we said yes to Celso, we said this is going to take a while, because we want to really make sure that we're not limited by time. The only limitation we want to have is our own creativity, basically. So we took the time to find the right people to record with, and to let the mix sit in, and let the arrangement sit in. And we're happy that we've taken that time, that we've given it the attention it deserves, because it is a massive project.
Yeah, I was about to say, paying that reverence to something that is so iconic in that scene and so well known as well, to take that and update it is, it sounds like you've really really paid all the time and dues you needed to do it.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
To go from one iconic label to another one, I want to talk about Heist. And, you know, you guys started this up in 2013. I mean, you know, it's super successful. The label looks as good as it sounds. I mean, why did you start the label up? And, you know, why was it so important for it to not only sound great and have brilliant releases on it, but also to look really cool as well in terms of the graphic design and all of those things just being one part of the project?
It was always a dream of mine to have my own label for some reason. I can't really give you an explanation why, but I just really like the idea of also being in control of your own stuff, but also being able to release other artists. But with everything I always want, I never think about how much work it actually is.
So true.
So in the end, Marta always takes the bigger chunk of the work, and I'm just the sort of floaty creative guy that thinks of all the crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we started it also because our friend Peter from Dirt Crew, he could get us a really good deal at Word and Sound, which is still our distributor. And they were so enthusiastic and they were so helpful. And they immediately said, well, this is your deal. Let's do it. We'll take anything off your hands. The only thing you have to do is artwork and A&R. Which is not entirely true, because we still have to do a lot of other stuff, obviously, because there's a lot of promo involved and a lot of like administrative stuff. Mm-hmm. But Peter, who still works for us, helped us a lot with this. Mm-hmm. And it also for us, like, we discussed it, and it's like a lot of labels out there, although they look very good on the outside, they are just run by enthusiastic people, but they don't have any idea how to run a label. Mm-hmm. Luckily, most of the labels that we released on are very professional, but there are also always some like a bit more cowboy labels. And we felt like, specifically because I was a promoter for such a long time, and Mart already was working at the ad agency, and we already started quite late as Damn Swindle, mm-hmm. Former Detroit Swindle. Mm-hmm. That we felt like, hey, we could really make this work. You know, we are business savvy. We know the game. We know what we want. We have a very clear idea of what we want to push. And also, we felt like there's a lot of artists like us out there that are really trying to push a sound that we really believe in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the aesthetic really comes from our designer, Boss, who we had a certain idea of, because of the Swindle, we wanted to do something with, you know, something with like a robbery or a thing. And then we came on to Heist, which we thought was such a nice sounding almost old school word, just mm-hmm. like Swindle, like something that people aren't using that much. And we felt like, hey, this is really cool. And what is the most precious thing that you could boost? And that's a diamond. And also because all the records that we release are just such gems in a way. So, we felt like, hey, let's use the diamond. And then our designer turned it into something that's like basically flipped on its side and way more abstract. Mm-hmm. And that immediately...
the fun thing was that when we came with the idea, he was
that's
like,
"That's true, yeah,
yeah, yeah, a diamond, yeah, that's nice. I've literally just done three projects where they wanted to do something with a diamond. It's done. Like, there's nothing more we can do. I'm going to leave that idea. Mm-hmm. I'm going to take your inspiration and create something completely different." That's what he said when we first like briefed him. And then when he came back, he was like, "Yeah, you remember when I said that we can't do anything with the diamond? Well, here's your new logo." And he's like, bam, he showed us the thing. And we're like, man, this is so good. Like, such a smart way to do something new with that. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the way it kind of modulates, because we started with the basic diamond, and then for each release we had a little twist in the design. Mm-hmm. So there was all this Like we even once created this whole scrolling website for Heist where we just every time you scrolled the logo would modulate. Mm-hmm. And it was just, it was such a hole in one. And the connection we have with him and his artistic view is great. And we have loads of discussions because he's horrible when you don't share his opinion.
Which is also another example of making really great art is in the end. All these discussions, they lead to something better. They create something better, and also something that's for him is also better to work on, you know?
Yeah. So then we have the Heist main series, and for the roundup, so where each artist remixes another artist from that year, we do special artwork. And if I see those collections, the collection of record sleeves that we've done, it has that clean look that we really like, but it's, in a way, it also really works in your imagination in a way, because, you know, there's this whole world, visual world of Heist to discover. And I think the aesthetic of the label after, and we're close to our 61st release right now, is just something, we've worked hard on, we've spent so much time and money on to do it right. And it pays off, as you say, you know, the people love the sound, people love the look. And it, you can just, if you see, if you walk into a record store, you can like pick out the record, you can pick out the label. And in the end, we both really feel like that adds value to the beautiful music that we get to put out. And it also adds value to people that buy it because they want to put it on display, or they're just, they're happy with the product. It looks great.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned those roundup EPs as well. They're always fantastic. Isn't it that you take tracks from the previous 12 months and you use artists from within the stable to, and it's by a random poll, is it, that they remix each
other? It's everyone from that year. So let's we take 2022 as an example. So we've had Nebraska do a release. We're doing a release. We have Maquez coming up, Krakazat, Byron the Aquarius, Cynthi, Orlando Vorn. Seven artists. We throw them in a bag and then we see who gets. So we remix Orlando Vorn, for instance, and then we decide with him together who which track to take. And, you know, that collection forms the roundup.
Yeah, that's fantastic. It's a great way of doing it. Are there any other, anyone's a bit annoyed with what they get given? Or is it always like, oh, actually, it's better that I've been given something and now I've got to work with
it? No, everyone loves the concept. And since it has this legacy, the label has this legacy, like any younger artist will never say that. They're just happy. but even like we had Scan 7 like 2 years back, you know, the old school Detroit guys, and they were like, they were cool with anything. They were like, yes, this is just a nice project to be on. And I think they remixed Alma Negra or something. So not at all related, and it turned out great.
So how do you discover new talent for the label, and how do you decide what gets put out?
Well, there's no one way about it, I would say. But with all respect to everyone that sends us demos, we get so many demos from unknown or starting producers that we hardly have the time to listen to be honest. We try to, but most of our talent comes from our network, basically, and through other artists that are like, hey, you should listen to these guys, or from us that we are listening to or buying tracks from these beginning artists that were like, hey, these are really good. Let's send them a little message to see if they're up for doing something on Heist. Or so, yeah, there's not one way about it, but it's mostly like direct connections, basically. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's people that we have an ongoing conversation with who have a super busy release schedule, and you kind of talk about the idea, and then they're either into it or not. And then when they're into it, but it doesn't fit the planning, I just kind of check in every now and then. And sometimes we see each other on like shared bookings and we talk about it. Sometimes we make jokes about this is taking way too long. Give me music now. And that kind of all depends on the person. So we have, we plan super far ahead. So we're never in a rush with people. We just want people to feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. They know the attention we spend to their music. So it's, you know, it gets a good home. Mm-hmm. And for some people, it's really And that's super, that's a major compliment. It's really a dream to release on Heist. Like, for instance, Philippe Gordon, he was like, so he's like, he's becoming Colombia's house music icon, but it's a super small scene and traveling for him is difficult. He is super productive and has done a lot of work on a lot of great labels, but he was like, yeah, I want to be on Heist so badly. And I think we really took the time. It took us like 2.5 years to get the right tracks together and to get the feel right. And but it was fine for him because he knew that we were giving it the attention it needed. And we were like super, we were in a really great conversation on what the music should sound like or how we should tweak the demos. And in the end, that's the only way you can like turn it into something great and something that you're all proud of. And I think the only like blunt demo that we've ever or artists, like it's completely unknown artists that we've ever released from that gave us demos are Marquez, two young Dutch guys who, you know, had their first clubbing experience on the sneaking into a club in Amsterdam when they were 16 and like handing over their USB to us. And you know, we did their album last year. We're going to do a follow-up EP. They are so talented. It's always this the trade-off between if you have these super popular names and they, you know, they're going to do well, so it's good for your label, it's good for them, and then you have these niche acts whose music you love and who, you know, like people won't even be able to pronounce their name, so they're doomed. And then we just try to make it work anyway because we believe in the music and we believe in their energy, and that's also what Heist is for. It's like it's a platform for people to, you know, it's a springboard.
Yeah,
because they get to use our popularity and the popularity of the label to grow their own profile, and we work really hard to help them with that.
Yeah, totally. And you know, so how would you describe the sound of the label if you had to in a few words? What would you sum it up as?
Yeah,
we recently said that, right? I don't remember what it was.
Warm house.
We kind of hate. Yeah,
this denominator. it's something you need for shops, but it's not something a producer needs when he or she is making music. I guess warm house with a lot of old school influences, sample heavy every now and then, does like fit the profile.
Yeah,
perfect.
I concur.
Cool. So it's good you both concur. So we're talking now, we've been talking about tracks in the label. Now we're going to move on to your choices for the playlist for the House Culture Perfect playlist, which you can find on Spotify. Every single one of our guests have submitted tracks to this playlist. So there are 5 different themes. You know, the playlist is huge. It's over 24 hours long because everyone submitted their 5 tracks. So it is full of left field choices, current bangers, old classics. You know, it's got everything in there. You guys have given me your choices up front, which is great. If I take you through the themes of each one that we've got, can you remember which ones you submitted, or do you want me to remind you?
No, we remember.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Great. Okay. So we always start off with a catalyst, a track that first got you into house music, dance music, electronic music, whatever you want to call it. What have you chosen and why have you chosen that track?
Well, the catalyst track is Paperclip People, Throw. For me, specifically very important track because as you remember earlier, I told you that I went into hard house and then I went into soul and funk a little bit and then back to house. And the back to house bit really came through this track specifically. I was working together with a friend of mine who makes music under the moniker Mark August. And he lives in Berlin now, and he really reintroduced me to electronic music through this album, basically this period of Carl Craig making music under Paperclip People. And I don't know what it was, but it just, this track just grabbed me straight away. And the way that the swing and the sort of also the bluntness of it almost. And that fueled the fire. And I literally started making, sort of mimicking this track in Reason, I was still using back then, I think, and trying to make specific sounding tracks just like this. Mm-hmm. And then from there, I just went into that corner of house music and really listened to all these more Detroit and then through Detroit sound, more Chicago, New York style house, and really explored that corner of house music. And that started really the road to what became the first Damn Swindle demos that Marta listened to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a true catalyst, really.
It's a great choice. And so we move on to a floor filler. You know, what is a go-to floor filler or a current floor filler? You know, what have you chosen there?
So we started when we were talking about this selection of five tracks, we had a bit of a discussion on what a floor filler is. Mm-hmm. Because I think that it actually, well, there's different interpretations. Like, mm-hmm. is it the track where people go wild on for the first time, or is it actually the track that gets people toward the dance floor?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be anything, but I think the track we selected for this is Heat by Rapson.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this track could have easily been on Heist because it has all the aspects that we love about house music: warmth, soulfulness, nice electronic chords, mm-hmm. but also a great vocal. And what I really love about the track, and why I think it works so well when you play it, is that kind of speed it gets once the vocal kicks in.
Mm-hmm.
And because the percussion is super basic and it's very minimalistically produced, which is such a talent, I think. And when it's one of those tracks that when you're ordering a drink at the bar, it just makes you turn your head like, what's on? Like, mm-hmm. what's the DJ playing? I like this. Like, and it's also a track that works for any sex.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like the guys can get into like the heavy bass stuff because it's super well produced and it has that sub going on, but then the vocal is super sexy and the like the chords are warm, so there's a little bit in there for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've noticed is that you can pretty much play it at any time, like on peak time when you kind of want to wind it down and like get dirty, or when you want to like get the party started and really get the energy going.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an amazing track. It really is.
Yeah, it's a great definition as well of those tracks that you hear when you are at the bar or you've got your drink in your hand and you're on the side of the dance floor and you hear it and you're like, this is the one that's going to make me move.
Exactly, yeah, it's a great tune.
Excellent. Okay, a sunsetter, what would you pick to soundtrack the perfect sunset?
Well, that's... because of a really nice experience, actually. It's The White Lamp. Mm-hmm. It's a huge Ron Bass Jam remix. And actually, our experience is not necessarily a sunset, but more a sun coming, I wouldn't say.
Rise?
No, not sunrise, because it wasn't the sunrise, because it was during the day. But I remember we were playing in Germany, mm-hmm. an outside festival. And it was during our set, it started pouring down, honestly. And there were, I think, 1,000 people standing in the sun outside, and they were just hammered with rain.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to put like a tarp over our DJ booth not to get all this stuff wet. And we kept playing under tarp and people were still dancing. And it was a bit awkward because it was literally like the sky cracked open and just dumped water on us.
Mm-hmm.
And then at one point, the clouds literally broke open, the sun came out, and I was already sort of seeing the moment coming. So I put this track on. And then at the moment that he starts singing about sun comes shining. Mm-hmm. And then at that moment, I kid you not, the sun started shining and I got goosebumps all over. Everybody went like, oh my God, like what the hell? And everybody was just standing there dancing like crazy.
That is brilliant.
And I was just, you couldn't have scripted it better. But obviously this track also really works well for sunrise because it has such a emotional, like now you and me, like us and the DJs and the crowd, we're gonna go somewhere together, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we chose this track, yeah.
What an experience.
Yeah, crazy. Goosebumps, really.
Absolutely. It's giving me goosebumps just hearing about it. I love that.
Yeah.
Okay, so A Tearjerker. This is, oh, I love this track so much. Why have you chosen this?
So we've chosen Could Heaven Ever Be Like This by Idris Muhammad. Mm-hmm. It's one of those tracks I talked about earlier that you don't want to play it too often because it you don't want like the magic, the track to lose its magic. Mm-hmm. Because it really, apart from the fact that we've played it on a magical moment, on a set in Wildeburg, an amazing festival in the Netherlands a few years back. It's a beautiful song. Like the strings, the vocals, the transitions, the fact it's like this soul disco opera that takes you through all these different emotions and types of energies. And when like the full 8.5 minutes or whatever, however long it is over, you just left there and you feel like you've experienced an entire lifetime of emotions through that one song. Mm. And it's a beauty. And I know that it's one of Lars's favorite songs. And I was record shopping at one point and I found the original in a bin somewhere, or in one of the like the old disco the records. So I picked it up and wanted to give it to him as a gift. Mm-hmm. But I didn't yet. And then we were playing Bilderberg, the festival, and we played a set from 6 a.m. in the morning till midday. Mm-hmm. And that was the only stage that was open by that time. So we had like the people that were coming in from the other stages. So, but there was also a lot of people that had just put their alarm. They went to bed early, put their alarm for the 6 a.m. set and came there. Mm-hmm. And we had, I think up to this moment, is still one of our most amazing DJ experiences where there was such an intimate connection with the crowd. Mm-hmm. And as one of the last songs, or maybe even the last song, I said, hey, I told Lars, hey, I have a gift for you. I'm going to play it now. Mm-hmm. So I put on the record and the sun was, it was midsummer and the sun was up and people were like, their clothes off and there's all these colorful people everywhere. And then I played the first few beats and Lars was close to crying out of sheer emotion. Mm-hmm. Instead, he like got up to the DJ booth, started dancing on the booth, got pulled into the crowd by a lot of our friends who were there. And we just danced throughout the full song and it was beautiful.
Mm. Yeah.
Wow.
Seriously.
Yeah.
You can't beat that.
No, it was really special.
Really special. Really special. Okay. A last tune. It's the end of the night. The crowd are asking for one more. What do you play?
Yeah, this is also a staple in our sets. It's Sarone, Hooked on You, but Con, King of Nothing, he made a nighttime edit, he calls it. And it's this slow sort of, it takes quite a while before it gets up to speed. And people are like, it's super long. And people are like, in the end, they're like super hyped up. And then you're playing this down tempo track and they're like, looking at each other, looking at us like, is this really the last track that you're going to play? Mm-hmm. And then it slowly evolves. And then the hook keeps repeating itself. And at one point, I will promise you, everybody will start dancing ecstatically. And I remember the one time I remember specifically was in Rotterdam and at Bird that we played it. And everybody was just jamming onto it. It's like they didn't want us that the track would end. And it's one of those tracks that really signature for Con as well. Like the way he programs the drums and repurposes the original stems. Mm-hmm. It's just, that's...
He's a master of this craft, man.
Yes.
Yeah, master of this craft. Yeah. And this one specifically, because it's a more down-tempo one, it really fits what he does and what he does well, and it also really fits a sort of, it's funny because you always have the idea I should play this banging track as the last track. That's my feeling always, but this one is sort of counters that, but does exactly the same thing, maybe even better.
Yeah, I think you've always, for me, on the dance floor, you've always got to trust a DJ when it's their last tune and it's not a banging one, and you're like, okay, this is going to be interesting and this is going to be something that I should take note of, because like you say, it is easy just to be like, I'm just going to put something on, it's just going to smash the place apart. But yeah, to make that decision and take that choice, you're obviously going to do something special.
Yeah, this track really makes people hug each other and just shared the love on the dance floor in a really intimate and warm way.
Amazing choices for the playlist. I know that the Con King of Nothing one is not available on,
that's
Spotify,
not on Spotify,
but don't worry. So what I'll do is, you know, people listening right now, they should just go out and seek that out, because, you know, it is incredible. And like you say, Con, master of his craft, so many of his edits, always that gold standard. You know, there's going to be something good in those. The final question we always have for our guests is that we are obviously house culture, and you guys are part of the fabric of the scene, you know, as a DJ duo, producers, remixers, label bosses. You've added so much. What does the scene as a whole kind of mean to you, and what does the culture of it bring to you in your life? How does that enrich that?
Well, for me personally, specifically during Corona, I really fell back in love with nightlife. I feel that it's such an integral part of the arts, basically. And I think house music is also one of the foundations of that. And I think what's happening now in the scene is maybe it's also commercializing a lot, but I don't necessarily see that as a bad thing, because, you know, way more people are introduced to electronic music, which is a good thing. And also I'm seeing with my students is that genres are not so important anymore in general. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, everything flows into something else and it turns out into something else. Like, I have students that are making pop songs with house beats and house tracks with drum and bass influences and whatnot. Like, everything flows into each other. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're doing, like, we're a bit more in from the classical approach. Like, we really like our classic house, and that's just what we like, and that's just what we want to hear. And to be fair, it's a bit hard to find really good classic house at the moment, or at least house made within our taste. It's there, but it's not very, what Marta said, that it's the sound has changed a bit. But I think it's always there. I always say to people, like, even though our sound is, when we started, it was very popular and it gained a lot of popularity, and then it sort of died down again, and then it came up again a little bit, and now it disco was a big thing for a couple of years, and now disco is a little bit on the down, and now tech house comes up, and then, but house is always at the back. It's always, it's universally there. It's basically the backbone of any electronic music sound. I think it will always be there. So it will always be there, hopefully.
Cool. Martin, what have you got to add to that?
I don't have Lars fell back in love with house music again. And I think I didn't really fall out of love with house music. Corona for me was a time where I started exploring actually my roots again a bit more with electro and techno, and finding the diversity in music also through my children, because they listen to a lot of different stuff. I have to put through a lot these days. Get to listen to,
I know the feeling.
Yeah, I get to listen to Justin Bieber. But to be honest, I've started to appreciate this diversity as well. Like, I think this is also partly what Lars said. Taste is something so personal, and your entrance into a specific genre could come from so many different things. Like, I mean, our stories are different as well. Like, Lars came from hard house, I came from electro and techno, and I came from punk, and we're making soulful house music together. It couldn't be more apart. And so when you see people get introduced to house music because they listened to Justin Bieber, who did a remix with whoever, I love that. I really, like, I couldn't emphasize it more to my kids. Like, I let them listen to everything. And then they like, hey, I love this. I was playing this, one of our demos on a festival for accidentally for like 5,000 or 6,000 people, because I was in the largest tent and it started pouring on the festival. So there were quite some people in already, to be fair, but then it filled up because people had nowhere else to go. And then I played one of our upcoming tracks for the next Damn Swindle EP. And my daughter was watching the Instagram clip and she was like, hey, you played this track before to me. I really like this. And she's like, she's the one like, I want to listen to Dua Lipa and I want to listen to Justin Bieber and whatever. So the fact that she, on her age, almost 10, like has that little influence of house music already, like woven into the commercial stuff that she likes, it gives me a great feeling about how the genre will evolve and how people will get introduced to it. Because Corona has been a weird time. People didn't have the curators, the DJs, the people that show these niche genres. Like, I mean, house still is a bit of a niche genre in the larger scheme of things. So suddenly they either get like super popular hard techno or they get into pop. And now they need like to be molded, like to be introduced to genres like house to discover acts like Dan Swindle, acts like Do We Have on Our Label. And that's also good. You know, it's fine that there's this diversity. So I embrace that. I embrace the changes that we go through, and we, you know, we pick the bits and pieces that we like, and our sound evolves as well. And in the end, that's a beautiful path we're on.
That's a brilliant final thought.
Yes.
That's awesome. Thank you so much, guys. That's incredible.
All right, man. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
House Culture.
How much fun was that? I love those guys. A couple of really nice fellas who are brilliant at what they do and, crucially, don't take themselves too seriously. I loved hearing that hilarious story about their Space Echo pedal, so you should definitely be on the lookout for that at any of their future gigs. Now, you heard the boys mention the third installment in their Essential Keep On Swindling series of EPs, and whilst you can pick up the first single called You out now, the whole thing will be released on the 2nd of December 2022. Do not miss out. Speaking of tracks, you can find our House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify. This is the epic collection that features Dan Swindle's thematic choices alongside selections from all of our previous podcast interviewees. And yes, if you're wondering, I have put the full 14 and a half minute version of Throw by Paperclip People, aka Carl Craig, into that list. What a journey it is. However, you'll have to seek out the Con Nighttime edit of Cerrone Hooked On You on YouTube, as it's not available on Spotify. So to make up for that shortfall in the list, you heard them talk all about it in the interview, I've added in their own remix of First Choice's classic disco number, Let No Man Put Asunder. Once you've followed that playlist and you've got it blasting out of your speakers, make sure you help support this podcast by loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, or even reviewing. We love to get your thoughts here at HCHQ. We will even give you a shout out if you have some nice things to say. This time I'd like to say a big hello to Gordon Everett, who goes by the name of Ultra Disco on Instagram. He told us how he really enjoyed our last episode with Dave Ralph. Well, thank you, Gordon. And I hope you've now started to work your way through the rest of our back catalogue of episodes. If you, dear listener, would like to see more of what we do, make sure you follow us on Instagram at HouseCultureNet, or by following that hashtag, TrueHouseCulture. Or, if you want to get in touch with me directly, you can do that on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.